Union College is sponsoring a talk by one of the country's foremost experts in sentencing policy, race, and the criminal justice system. Mark Maurer is the executive director of the Sentencing Project and the co-author of the new book, The Meaning of Life, The Case for Abolishing Life Sentences. He's authored numerous other books, including Race to Incarcerate, which was later published as a graphic novel, and a frequent contributor to the New York Times, The Washington Post, National Public Radio, and many other media sources. He is here in our studio, and we are thrilled to have him. It's a great pleasure to welcome Mark Maurer to the program. How are you?
Good. Great to be here. Thanks.
Very nice to have you on the show. How did you fall into this line of work?
Well, I was a grad student in a Master of Social Work program at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, and needed to do a field placement. And there was a Quaker office in town, the American Friends Service Committee, their social justice arm, and they were working on a small bail reform project, starting a community bail fund for post-bail for people who couldn't afford to get out before their trials, and trying to make the case that money buys freedom in the justice system to some extent. So I started working with them and started going to prisons and looking around and talking to people, and one thing leads to another over several decades.
The subtitle of the new book is The Case for Abolishing Life Sentences. In your opinion, the mission statement in making that case is what?
Well, that basically if we care about public safety, that life sentences actually are counterproductive. And the reason primarily is because we know that people age out of crime. People in their mid-teen years are at a higher risk involved in criminal behavior. We can all think back to our teen years and mistakes and misbehaviors and bad things we may have done, but we know that by the time people get to their mid to late 20s, the risk involved in a crime starts to diminish, certainly by 30s, 40s, and 50s. So what we have is that as people serve a life sentence for each successive year over, say, age 40, we're getting less and less crime prevention. It comes at a greater and greater cost. So it's a real mismatch of our public safety resources.
Here's a figure that you use in the book. So one out of seven people in the United States in prison is currently serving a life sentence. Let's say that's 200,000 people, which you say is the entire prison population. Snapshot 1972.
Exactly. It's remarkable. And, you know, this is what we've come to call mass incarceration resulting from the tough on crime movement. You know, the tough on crime movement was devoted to sending more people to prison, keeping them there for longer periods of time. And one of the many outgrowths of that was the huge expansion of life imprisonment through policies like mandatory sentencing, three strikes and you're out, and the like. You know, one of the more extreme cases in California, when they first adopted three strikes, your third strike could be any felony in the state of California. So we had two cases come to the U.S. Supreme Court charging cruel and unusual punishment. One of them, a man, had stolen three golf clubs from a sporting goods store, his third strike. The other one, on two occasions, had stolen $153 worth of videotapes from Kmart stores. Supreme Court turned down the argument. They deferred to the California legislature to deal with the crime policy, so the golf club thief got 25 to life, and the videotape thief got 50 to life. Now, extreme cases, yes, but nonetheless an indication of just how far we've gone in our zeal to punish, far beyond any real crime control purposes.
So the obvious question that I'm sure people are screaming at the radio right now is, well, what about parole?
Well, when we document 206,000 people serving life sentences, some have a sense of life without the possibility of parole, some life with the possibility, and others are what we call virtual life sentences of 50 years or longer. And, you know, for certain types of crimes, yes, a person will get a life sentence, but with the possibility of parole. And the main reason for that is that on the day of sentencing, no one in the courtroom, judge, prosecutor, defense attorney, knows what that person is going to be like in 10 or 20 years. So yes, there is punishment, but we have to allow for the possibility of personal transformation.
So this statistic surprised me that two-thirds of the population of the people who are serving life in federal prisons are serving for nonviolent crimes. How does that happen? How does someone, as you say, you use the videotape example, how does that happen where the crime would be so severe that they would get a life sentence?
Well, this flows out of federal crime policies of the last 20 years. We had the mandatory penalties for crack and powder cocaine in the 1980s. The 1994 federal crime bill, a major initiative of President Bill Clinton, contained a three strikes and you're out provision. Now, it could be three violent felonies, but could also be three drug crimes. Now, to be sure, these are not kids on the street corner selling small quantities of drugs. These are people selling substantial quantities of drugs. Nonetheless, it means that on your third such drug offense, you get a sentence of life in prison, and there's no parole in the federal system now.
You said something earlier, and I meant to write it down, and I didn't. And now it's sort of I want to make sure I have it correct. But you said, or something to the effect of the people, they age out of the criminal behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that mean? So in other words, they get better.
They get better. They grow up. You know, what happens generally is when we're teenagers, we're kind of impulsive. We lack maturity. We don't have a very good vision of the future. We reach our 20s, and most of us grow up. We become adults. So we may get married. We have jobs. We have families and the like. And all of a sudden, those things we did as teenagers don't look so enticing anymore. We also start to slow down, too. You know, we don't want to stay out late at night and hang around in street corners with our friends. And this is true for people involved in crime as well. If you look at the sort of crime trajectory of people's lives, it's very clear-cut. It may start to decline in the early 20s, maybe in the late 20s, but the risk of being involved in crime diminishes considerably after 10 or 20 years.
We use that word correctional facility.
Mm-hmm.
So we're correcting, we're doing something to correct the behavior and punishment, but to correct it. In your mind, how often does that work where the problem is actually corrected?
Well, it's nice that we have that sort of theoretical commitment to correction, but in the last 40 years, the era of mass incarceration, the whole notion of what these institutions should do has really shifted from trying to correct people, or at least that was the philosophy, now punishment and warehousing in many institutions. That's beginning to change in recent years. The main problem now is that even though many of the corrections leadership have bought into this idea that we should prepare people in prison to go home at some point, the degree of resources put into that is so modest that given the scale of the problem, it's very difficult to have major successes.
Mark Maurer is the co-author of the new book, The Meaning of Life, the subtitle, The Case for Abolishing Life Sentences, and he'll be speaking at Union College at 12:50 this afternoon, so in just about an hour and 10 minutes. And his talk is titled, How to Lock Up Fewer People. So how do you lock up fewer people and still keep our streets safe?
Mm-hmm. I think we do in two ways primarily. One is we're sending far too many people to prison who could be much better served under community supervision. Prison to some extent protects us from people who might harm us, but it also has a lot of negative consequences. It separates people from their families and communities. It's a very stressful, often dangerous environment. So we should be avoiding prison whenever possible, particularly for people who've committed nonviolent crimes, drug crimes. There's a variety of ways that we can supervise them under community control. And secondly, we have to look at the scale of punishment. The reason we have mass incarceration is because we send more to prison, but we keep them there much longer than other nations. You know, even if you go to prison for stealing a car, not a most serious crime, you're going to spend more time in prison than if you did the same act in England, Italy, Germany, many other nations.
You spend a lot of time in the book, and I found it illuminating, which is looking at a large part of this population, which is juveniles.
Mm-hmm.
Juvenile transfer laws. What are those laws, and what has that part of the system allowed to happen?
Yeah. Well, juvenile transfer laws proliferated really in the 1980s and 1990s. Yes, there was a surge in crime overall and juvenile crime in the late 80s, but in most states, legislators really overreacted. And so they passed laws that to varying degrees take cases of 15, 16, or 17-year-olds and try them in adult court where the penalties can be far more severe. The juvenile court historically has a focus on rehabilitation. The adult courts, it's much more looking at punishment and incapacitation. So as a result, until some recent Supreme Court decisions, there are 2,500 people serving life without parole sentences for crimes that they committed when they're under the age of 18. Scholars have looked around the world to see what comparable policies there are. The total number of people serving such sentences elsewhere is exactly two. There are two cases in Australia that we know about. So just a glimpse as to how extreme some of our policies have become.
With that is, I have a bunch of questions, but one is about mental health. How does that figure into this?
Well, you know, in many places in the country, Los Angeles, the county jail is often described as the largest mental health facility in the state of California, and you can see similar conditions in other states as well. The population in prison that suffers from mental health issues, depending on how you define it, ranges from maybe one in six to one of every two people in prison with serious mental health problems. And this doesn't excuse the crimes they may have committed, but it does help us to understand something about how they got there. You think about a prison environment, which even for people who are quite mentally healthy can be extremely damaging, the stress, the isolation there, and then you wonder, what does it do for someone who's got serious mental health challenges? So, you know, what we're seeing essentially is that the lack of sufficient mental health services in the community doesn't cause, but does contribute to some of these outbreaks that we see, some of these tragedies in some cases, when the underlying problem is not addressed very appropriately.
When, but we think of systems, you know, our mental health system, the foster care system, the prison system. I mean, those systems, I mean, they have great faults, but they all seem to kind of fall on their own weight, right? And impact one another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you got to fix them all, it seems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we do have to fix them all, and we don't want to be overwhelmed by the magnitude of the problem to say there's nothing we can do. You know, there's intriguing examples of local jurisdictions trying to have an impact. So on mental health issues, city of Memphis, Tennessee has been a leader for many years. You know, when the police get a call, say, for a domestic violence situation or something like that, the police will be the first to tell you, look, we're not trained as mental health practitioners, but we go out to a crime scene, and we just have a feeling that something is not right here, is what they'll often say. So the program they've adopted is that when they suspect that a call may be really an underlying mental health issue, a police officer goes out there with a social worker, and together they try to identify what kind of problem is this and how should we respond. Is this a criminal justice issue, or is it a public health, a mental health issue? And trying right from the start to divert people into the most appropriate way to handle the problem. Because once you come in the justice system, it's very difficult to get out of it. And the services available for mental health issues are just extremely slim in most cases.
When you think about this idea of criminal justice reform, that meant one thing in the 90s. What does it mean now?
Well, in recent years, we're seeing starting to see a shift in the political environment on these issues. You know, we had more than three decades of tough on crime, lock 'em up types of policies. Now we have actions, as we saw just in the end of this past year, in Congress passing the First Step Act, some modest sentencing reforms, increases in prison programming at federal prisons. It was supported by the ACLU, traditionally liberal groups, and also supported by the Koch brothers and Jared Kushner and others.
Right.
So a real coming together finally, recognizing that we've gone way too far in our zeal to punish. It's time to look at other ways to approach these issues.
The other ways, how are we doing on those?
We're doing okay in some cases. New York State has really been a leader in terms of trying to reduce its prison population. The numbers behind bars are down by about a third in the last 15 years. New Jersey and Connecticut have done similar approaches too. Much of this in many states has focused on diverting people convicted of substance abuse crimes. And the idea here is that when substance abuse is the underlying condition that's leading to some crimes, treatment programs, either through drug courts or some other type of services, may be a much better approach. If we deal with the underlying problem, then we can deal with the criminal problem as well. So we're seeing some elements of that. The challenge is, you know, as we point out in the book on life imprisonment, we do need to look at more serious crimes, including violent crimes as well, because we do know that many of these acts are situational. People may lash out in a very difficult situation and may make some very tragic mistakes, but that doesn't necessarily define who they are completely and also ignores the possibility that they can transform themselves in a prison environment and be ready to come out someday. We need to be thinking about how to make that a possibility as well.
How does the Sentencing Project fit into all of this?
Well, we're a 32-year-old nonprofit based in Washington, D.C. We're engaged in research and advocacy on criminal justice policy. We work very closely with lawmakers in Washington and also at the state level. We're trying to bring research evidence to bear in how we develop criminal justice policy. We're trying to bring the voices of people affected by these systems into the minds of policymakers, which means we need to hear from victims, we need to hear from perpetrators, we need to hear from corrections officials to get them as part of the mix. Part of the reason we have this problem, mass incarceration, is that the whole policy debate became one of sound bites. You know, I support three strikes and you're out, I support two strikes and you're out. Political campaigns were frequently won and waged on these tough-on-crime policies. We know that that doesn't get us very far. We do know there's research and evidence on what works and what doesn't work, and we need to expand the range of voices that are part of that conversation. And the beginnings of that are starting to take place now.
Do you find that the with the climate, with the political climate, do you worry that some of this may get lost just because of other things that are going on? I guess I think of what's happening on our borders and what's happening with immigration and what's happening of a lot of talk about violent offenders and caravans and people coming in and of what that does to our overall, for want of a better term, although maybe there isn't one, of fear-mongering.
Mm-hmm. No, it's very troubling, certainly. And we see this imagery, the stereotyping. You know, we saw it in different ways in the drug war of the 1980s, and now the targets are generally immigrant families who are fleeing violence and poverty in their home countries and the like. And, you know, just out of thin air, just talking about these stereotypes have no basis in reality. We and many others have provided documentation showing that immigrants actually are involved in criminal activity at a far lower rate than native-born Americans are. I think many political leaders and people in the public understand this, but it is very troubling and concerning when we hear this imagery on the nightly news and coming out of the White House far too often. It's very hard to have a rational discussion about these issues when that's the kind of imagery that's floating in front of us every day.
Since you have been a part of this for so long, what are the major changes that you've seen that you're proud of, that you think are constructive changes to our system and what has happened?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think our notions about the war on drugs have really changed. Part of it's because I think almost every American family has someone close to them who's had a drug or alcohol problem. And I think when we are close to those problems, we recognize that putting somebody in a prison cell for 5 years and not doing anything about that problem doesn't get us very far. So if it's someone we care about, we try to get them in treatment, we try to get them in help. And if it doesn't work the first time, we keep trying. And I think that recognition is growing now, so that we're seeing the policymakers and practitioners starting to adopt programs that can put that into place, again, through diversion programs, drug court programs, and the like, looking at those things. Secondly, I think there's a growing recognition about what we call the collateral consequences of having a felony conviction, that once you have a conviction, it doesn't end at the end of the sentence. It follows you the rest of your life. One of the major barriers to reintegration is the loss of the right to vote, depending on which state you're in. And just this past November, voters in Florida approved by a wide margin a vote to re-enfranchise people who've completed their felony sentences yet were subject to a lifetime ban. So more than 1 million people in Florida now have the right to vote they didn't have before. And it's a real tribute to a growing sense of what democracy should look like.
It's a good point. I mean, you're based in Washington, D.C., but I mean, this does change from state. Some states do a lot better than others.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, there's a very broad range. The good news in terms of challenging mass incarceration, as I mentioned, there are half a dozen states similar to New York. We've seen a significant one-third or so reduction in population. If you look across the country, though, the scale of change is far too modest given the scale of the problem. We did an analysis at the Sentencing Project recently, and we said, what would it take at the current rate of decarceration to reduce the prison population by 50%? And the answer was, it'll take 75 years. Well, we don't have that much time to wait to deal with this problem, so clearly we need a much more expansive approach. We need to step up the pace if we want to get back to any sensible rate of criminal justice use of resources all around.
The talk that you'll be doing at Union College, I know you're doing several, you've been doing several talks in our region. What is it like to speak to young people about these issues and to get them involved and to help combat some of the problems?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's very encouraging. What we've seen in recent years, I think a lot of the movement for change and the demand for change is coming from young people. It's through the movement of Black Lives Matter. It's through young people getting involved in their communities and looking at incarceration, marches for jobs, not jails, and the like. I think many young people have become very energized about politics in recent years for a host of reasons. And are now seeing mass incarceration incarceration is a very defining moment, a defining policy that needs to be addressed. We're seeing in, you know, popular films and culture now focusing on these issues as well. So I think there's a lot of education to be done. There's a lot of engagement with policymakers needs to happen, but there are very promising signs, and that's why we like to spend time with young people engaging, talking about what needs to be done strategically, how are we going to shift things around.
The name of the new book is The Meaning of Life, The Case for Abolishing Life Sentences. Mark Maurer and Ashley Nellis are the authors. The book is out from the New Press. Mark Maurer is our guest. He is the executive director of the Sentencing Project and the co-author of The Meaning of Life. His talk at Union College begins at 12:50. It's titled How to Lock Up Fewer People, and you can find out more about that by going to union.edu, union.edu. Mark, thank you very much for sharing with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.